Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 361, Networking. This is being recorded on June 2nd of 2002. We're reviewing not only some of the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm's connections, going all the way back to the Third Reich, all the way back to the Allen-Dulles relationship to King Ibn Saud, one of whose friends was Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father. We took a look for the first time in this broadcast at the fact that the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm serves as the legal advisor to the Saudi bin Laden group. In recent weeks, as I'm speaking on June 2nd of 2002, there has been much discussion of what the FBI and or other intelligence services knew about September 11th, what might they have disclosed, what Bush should or should not have known or done. There's been a lot of recrimination in the media. By way of understanding some of the dynamics, I think it's important to understand networking, as I explained in the first half of the program. And when one sees the Saudi bin Laden group having as its legal counsel Sullivan and Cromwell, one is looking at a corridor of power, of finance, of oil, and of a very, very, very significant relationship that stretches all the way back to the post-World War I period and that has been amplified over the years and that has grown more powerful. And it is this networking, this milieu, of which both George Bush, the younger George Bush, as well as the older George Bush, and the very powerful bin Laden family are part. And this is a milieu that overlaps the Islamo-fascist milieu and the milieu of the Third Reich in its above-ground and post-World War II underground phases. We're going to bring some of this networking up to the present, and in terms of understanding why things get covered up, understand institutional inertia, understand the old phrase that, what tangled webs we weave when we practice to deceive. That sounds a little corny, perhaps, but also understand that once people start doing things that are illegal, and once money is being made, once reputations have been made, the inclination is to cover up. And in terms of understanding some of the dynamics, I think it's important to understand some of this networking. Also bear in mind my ruminations in a number of broadcasts that I think the FBI has been is in the process of being destabilized, and that in fact a fifth column with allegiances to what I call the Underground Reich, but using some of these networks in order to infiltrate and using some of these compromised and compromising relationships, that it is that fifth column that helped to subvert U.S. intelligence from within. That fifth column was established in order to, among other things, fight the Cold War. That's how some of these Nazis got into the United States in the first place. It also, the fifth column involving Islamo-fascists was used to fight the former Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and there is considerable evidence that elements of the Al-Qaeda network were later utilized not only in the Balkans, specifically in Bosnia, and perhaps in Kosovo. There's also evidence that some of these Al-Qaeda slash Wahhabi networks have been utilized by the petroleum-related factions of the intelligence community, not only to destabilize Chechnya and Dagestan, but also some of these Al-Qaeda networks have been active in Bosnia. In turn, some of these networks working, I believe, for the Underground Reich and for the related milieu of Islamo-fascism have infiltrated and are destabilizing the United States. And I believe that, at the risk of perhaps seeming a little bit corny and ridiculous, that the war that we are currently engaged in is literally an extension of World War II, resumed after 50-plus years, involving some of the same economic interests, some of the same compromising political connections, and involving the use of the Muslim populations of what the Nazis referred to as the Earth Island, the giant landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the former Soviet Union, most of the Middle East, India, and China. That giant landmass controlling most of the world's not only landmass, but its petroleum reserves, and it brackets a huge swatch of the world's Muslim population, which was seen by the Third Reich in its above-ground and post-World War II underground phases as being the key to controlling the world. Now, networking, Sullivan and Cromwell, the Bush family, bringing some of this on up to the present. This is by way of review. Turning once again to The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, bearing in mind Sullivan and Cromwell's work on behalf of Saudi Bin Laden Group, also bearing in mind the major past discussion of business connections between the younger George Bush and the Bin Laden interests, also bearing in mind the presence of some of the Al-Taqwa / NADA management milieu on the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, which in the past has embraced European fascists and now appears to be embracing, among others, Islamo-fascists or people from that milieu. In The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus and Mark Ahrens review the Bush family's heritage of aligning with the Third Reich and Sullivan and Cromwell. Apart from disclosing that, quote, Grandfather Walker, unquote, came from a devout Catholic family, was named after the poet George Herbert, and formed his own investment firm, George Herbert Walker Bush revealed practically nothing about his grandfather in his autobiography. However, there was another, far seamier side to George Walker. Walker was one of Hitler's most powerful financial supporters in the United States. The relationship went all the way back to 1924 when Fritz Thyssen, the German industrialist, was financing Hitler's infant Nazi party. As mentioned in earlier chapters, there were American contributors as well. Some Americans were just bigots and made their connections to Germany through Alan Dulles' firm of Sullivan and Cromwell because they supported fascism. The Dulles brothers, who were in it for profit far more than ideology, arranged American investments in Nazi Germany in the 1930s to ensure that their clients did well out of the German economic recovery. Quote, Dulles clearly emphasized projects for Germany and for Mussolini's fascist state. All told, these and more than a dozen similar transactions had a combined value in excess of $1 billion. Unquote. By the way, I would note that one of the heirs to Fritz Thyssen, Heinrich Thyssen Bornemisza, who died in April of 2002, was based in Lugano, Switzerland, which is also the epicenter for Al-Taqwa / NADA management, and also for the very closely related conduit, the Banco del Gottardo, which also overlaps the milieu of the Clearstream network and which has conduits going all the way back to François Genoux, one of the most mysterious post-war operators, not only in Nazi finance, but in the Muslim world. We've spoken about him many times. One of the many firms that the elder George Walker was, that George Herbert Walker was involved in, that's George W.'s great-grandfather, was the Hamburg America line. That also, as we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 273, became a major element of the post-war Bormann organization. In fact, it was at the August 10th, 1944 meeting in Strasbourg that the SS General Dr. Scheid gave, among other addresses, a New York address, apparently for the Hamburg America line, to the assembled Nazi industrial and financial elite. This in the planning for the post-war flight capital network, which was to finance the German Nazi Party, among other things, in its post-war campaign. Again, bear in mind Lugano, Switzerland, embracing Heinrich Thyssen Bornemisza, one of the primary elements of the post-war Bormann network, also the epicenter for NADA management, Al-Taqwa, and Banco del Gottardo, which overlaps it. Speaking of George Herbert Walker, Walker also set up a deal to take over the North American operations of the Hamburg America line, a cover for I.G. Farben's Nazi espionage unit in the United States. The shipping line smuggled in German agents, propaganda, and money for bribing American politicians to see things Hitler's way. The holding company was Walker's American Shipping and Commerce, which shared the offices at 39 Broadway with the Union Banking Corporation. In an elaborate corporate paper trail, Harriman's stock in American Shipping and Commerce was controlled by yet another holding company, the Harriman 15 Corporation, run out of Walker's office. The directors of this company were Averill Harriman, Burt Walker, and Prescott Bush. Skipping down. At some point, Prescott Bush, by the way, that's the elder George's father, George W.'s grandfather, at some point Prescott Bush must have realized that his father-in-law was, to put it mildly, a very shady character. A 1934 congressional investigation alleged that Walker's, quote, Hamburg America line subsidized a wide range of pro-Nazi propaganda efforts both in Germany and the United States. And again, in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning accessed German documents which were captured by the Treasury Department during the closing phases of World War II, in which specifically the Hamburg America line was mentioned as a firm that had been very useful in protecting German assets abroad. And then SS General Dr. Scheid gave a number of New York addresses to the assembled industrialists and financiers. Now, who helped to shield the assets, including Union Banking Corporation and the Hamburg America line? To this day, we do not know if Prescott Bush stayed on board out of loyalty to his father-in-law or because the money was so good. Instead of divesting the Nazi money, Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. According to Dulles' client list at Sullivan and Cromwell, his first relationship with Brown Brothers Harriman was on June 18, 1936. In January 1937, Dulles listed his work for the firm as Disposal of Standard Oil Investing Stock. So going, again, networking, money, oil, all the way from post-World War I through Sullivan and Cromwell, right on up through Sullivan and Cromwell's work as counsel for Saudi Bin Laden Group. Now, in terms of understanding some of the institutional inertia which can lead to cover-ups, and bearing in mind that we all have resumes, we all have professional self-esteem, not to mention our legal reputations and our financial security, and using the editorial we here, in terms of understanding why, for example, warnings about September 11th might have been covered up, and to understand the types of relationships that can lead to compromising by the underground Reich, let's turn to the following from the Wall Street Journal of May 29th of 2002. This is an article by Jerry Markon, M-A-R-K-O-N, or Markon. It's headlined, Trader and Former Agent in Alleged Stock Scam Had Data from FBI. It reads in part, a former FBI agent charged in a stock manipulation scheme had classified data among his belongings, and the trader he is accused of conspiring with had investigative reports about companies that were illegally taken from the FBI, prosecutors told a federal court judge. The disclosures, at an arraignment in Brooklyn at which prosecutors argued against freeing former agent Jeffrey A. Royer on bail, were the first tantalizing bits of evidence revealed in the case against the two men along with three others, including a current FBI agent. Prosecutors told the court that Mr. Royer's FBI business card was discovered paperclipped to an envelope marked FBI, unquote, in the office of the stock trader and internet commentator he is accused of conspiring with, Amir Anthony Elgindy, E-L-G-I-N-D-Y. Inside the envelope were confidential FBI reports about public companies facing criminal or other probes. Well, whatever the criminal culpability in this case of Amir Anthony Elgindy, note some of the networking, because Amir Anthony Elgindy, his father Ibrahim, and his brother Khaled Elgindy are involved with some very, very interesting network, which certainly overlaps the milieu of not only Hamas, but quite possibly Al-Qaeda. It also overlaps the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization and its Islamo-fascist connections. And among the many names involved with some of this networking is the name of Talat Altman, one one of the associates of Ibrahim El-Gindi. This is not to be misunderstood necessarily as charging any criminal culpability on the part of any of the El-Gindis. That remains to be determined by the court. But there are some very, very interesting networks indeed. And bear in mind that two FBI agents, former FBI agents, have been indicted for providing information to Mr. El-Gindi. And the networking going on here goes through some very, very interesting corridors indeed. And in terms of understanding some of the institutional inertia which can lead to compromising with often devastating results, consider, among other things, the following. This also from the Wall Street Journal. This from May 24th of 2002. That was a Friday. This is an article by Michael Schroeder and Gary Fields in Washington and Ianth Jean Dugan and Aaron Elstein in New York. It's headlined, Terror Probes Led to Stock Fraud Case. The investigation that led to charges against five people, including a current and a former FBI agent with using confidential government data to manipulate stock prices, was an almost accidental result of probes into the September 11th terror attacks and, to some degree, convicted spy Robert Hansen. By the way, bear in mind that John P. O'Neill, in charge of the FBI's investigation into bin Laden and killed in the September 11th attacks, had quit the FBI, charging, according to a recently published book, that the connections between American corporations and Saudi Arabia had led to a cover-up of the Saudi role in financing Islamic terrorism, including al-Qaeda. Bear in mind that he had a briefcase with information containing specifics about every counter-terrorist and counterintelligence operation in New York City that was stolen in the summer of 2000 from the late John P. O'Neill. Whether or not that's relevant to this context. Continuing with this May 24th Wall Street Journal article, authorities began looking into the activities of Anthony El-Gindi, an Egyptian-born investor who was among those indicted as part of the wide-ranging net cast by investigators looking for potential financiers of Muslim groups with links to terrorism last fall, according to a Federal Bureau of Investigation official. By the way, Anthony El-Gindi had become a well-known figure in internet stock advice, or in the world of internet stock advice. He also had some other interesting connections as well. Continuing, skipping down, the origins of the FBI's terror-related interest in Mr. El-Gindi are unclear, but it might have stemmed from a tip that was provided by angry executives from small companies who banded together to fight him for wreaking havoc on their stock by selling borrowed shares in hopes of turning a profit if the stock falls. After September 11th, those executives approached the FBI with a tip about Mr. El-Gindi's possible short-selling of key industry stocks ahead of the terrorist attacks, the executives involved said. His adversaries also pointed out that Mr. El-Gindi is a Muslim whose brother, Khaled El-Gindi, is active in Islamic advocacy groups in Washington. Bear in mind the raids in suburban Washington on March 20th that netted some of the people and some of the institutions that were involved with al-Taqwa. Khaled El-Gindi delivered humanitarian aid to Iraqis in May 1998 with a U.S. group called the International Relief Association, according to news accounts at the time. Bear in mind, neither Khaled El-Gindi nor his brother, or his father, rather, Ibrahim, also the father of Anthony, have been charged with any criminal activity. However, in the indictment that are in a court hearing in San Diego, the assistant United States attorney basically implied that Anthony El-Gindi may have had foreknowledge of the September 11th attacks and was engaged in short selling. This is an article from the New York Times by Alex Berenson. This is from the New York Times of Saturday, May 25th of 2002, headline, Stock Advisor Knew About 9/11 Attacks, U.S. Suggests. It reads in part as follows. A San Diego stock advisor who is accused of bribing an FBI agent to give him confidential government information may have had prior knowledge of the September 11th attacks, a federal prosecutor said yesterday. In a court hearing in San Diego, Kenneth Breen, an assistant United States attorney, said the advisor, Amir Ibrahim El-Gindi, tried to sell $300,000 in stock on the afternoon of September 10th and told his broker that the stock market would soon plunge. Quote, "Perhaps Mr. Elgindy had pre-knowledge of September 11th, and rather than report it, he attempted to profit from it," unquote, Mr. Breen said. Mr. Breen, coordinator of the stock market unit of a government task force set up to investigate financing for terrorist groups, offered no other evidence that Mr. Elgindy had prior knowledge of the attacks. A lawyer for Mr. Elgindy said the allegation was ludicrous and appeared to be motivated by the fact that Mr. Elgindy is a Muslim and was born in Egypt. Senior FBI officials also said they had no evidence that Mr. Elgindy had prior knowledge of the attacks. In the hearing yesterday, Mr. Breen asked Judge John A. Houston of Federal District Court in San Diego to hold Mr. Elgindy without bond. Mr. Elgindy, also known as Tony Elgindy and Anthony Pacific, recently moved $700,000 to Lebanon and is a serious flight risk, Mr. Breen said. The judge did hold Mr. Elgindy, but not for the allegations made by Mr. Breen, but because he had apparently had ammunition, which violated, firearms ammunition, which violated the parole terms of a previous conviction. Skipping down. At the hearing yesterday, Mr. Breen said that on the afternoon of September 10th, Mr. Elgindy contacted his broker at Salomon Smith Barney and asked him to sell $300,000 in stock in his children's trust funds. During the September 10th conversation, Mr. Elgindy predicted that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which at the time stood at about 9,600, would soon crash to below 3,000, Mr. Breen said. Mr. Elgindy was unable to sell the stock before markets closed September 10th, and it was instead sold September 18th, the first day that markets reopened for trading after the attacks, Mr. Breen said. The Solomon Smith Barney broker contacted the FBI after the attacks to report the conversation, Mr. Breen said. He did not identify the broker. A spokesman for Solomon Smith Barney confirmed that Mr. Elgindy was a client, but said that Solomon did not comment on matters relating to its clients. Mr. Elgindy also transferred more than $700,000 to Lebanon in the months after the attacks, Mr. Breen said. When FBI agents raided Mr. Elgindy's home outside San Diego on Wednesday, Mr. Breen said they found $43,000 in cash, as well as a loose diamond and faxes indicating that Mr. Elgindy had been tipped about the raid and had given his wife a power of attorney to liquidate his assets. Skipping down. Mr. Elgindy's father and brother are also active in Arab and Muslim causes. His father, Ibrahim Elgindy, founded an umbrella group of Muslim organizations in Chicago and led a 1998 protest on behalf of Muhammad A. Salah, whose assets were seized that year after the United States government linked Mr. Salah to Hamas, the radical Palestinian group. Mr. Elgindy's brother Khaled has worked for several Arab political groups as well. Bear in mind the name Ibrahim Elgindy and work on behalf of Mohammed Salah. This is from the New York Times of Saturday, May 11th of 2002. It's an article by Judith Miller, Dateline, Washington, May 10th. Headlined, FBI Agent Sues Bureau for Barring Terror Book. An FBI agent has sued the Bureau for refusing to let him publish a book about what he says were botched efforts to investigate fundraising by Hamas and other militant Islamic networks in the United States in the 1990s. Skipping down. Mr. Wright's investigation led to the seizure in June of 1998 of $1.4 million in the bank accounts of Mohammed Salah, a Chicago resident who had served time in an Israeli prison after being convicted of helping to recruit and train for Hamas. Investigators said they traced Mr. Salah's bank transactions to specific terrorist attacks, including one in which an Israeli soldier was killed. Skipping down. In his complaint, Mr. Wright said that the funds were linked to Yassin Qadi, a Saudi businessman whom the federal government designated last October as a financial supporter of Osama bin Laden. Mr. Qadi, who lives in Jeddah, has denied links to terrorists. In For the Record 353 and in number 331, we took a look at the fact that the Mowafaq network, one of the institutions being investigated, also involves Khalid bin Mahfouz. I would also note that one of the people involved with Ibrahim Elgandi in an organization called the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago is none other than Talat Otman, who in turn was a director of Harkin Energy, who also participates in many organizations with individuals and financial assets that overlap the milieu of Al-Taqwa and Nada management, whatever their culpability in some of the alleged activities might be. We took a look at Talat Otman in For the Record 356 and some of the connections between what I called an Islamo-fascist Enron-like network in For the Record 357 and came back to them in 359 as well. In a public document, a PR document basically, about the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago, the networking between Ibrahim Elgandi and Talat Otman is discussed. I will give the full URL on the website. In 1989, Mr. Ibrahim Elgandi invited Muslim leaders from across the Chicago area to discuss the possibility of uniting this enormous yet fractured community into one voice. An ad hoc committee was formed, led by Mr. Talat Otman and Mr. Mohammed Kasiruddin, to investigate and study this important and ambitious task. Ibrahim Elgandi involved on behalf of Mohammed Salah. And again, some of this networking is very interesting to observe. Wall Street Journal, May 21st of 2002, has an article headlined, "Bush Faces Widening Gap with Europe," by Ian Johnson in Bern, Switzerland, Christopher Cooper in London, and Philip Shishkin in Brussels. U.S. method of naming terrorism suspects meets with growing dissent. Skipping down. "The Americans are good in intelligence information," says an Italian official who has followed Bank Al-Taqwa, a Bahamas-based lender that the U.S. alleges financed the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Again quoting, "but they provide little that can be used in court. We're still waiting for real information." I would note that intelligence information and what can be legally proved are two very, very different institutions. I would also note that the recent disclosures about the FBI investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui referred to the investigation of people connected to Ramzi Youssef, specifically a fellow named Hakim Murad. Turning back to Holy War Incorporated, of some of the interesting connections of Ramzi Youssef, we see the fact that his uncle worked for a subsidiary of Mercy International, which in turn was alleged in Dollars for Terror to be a subsidiary of Global Office and Al-Taqwa / Nada Management. A further interesting connection between Youssef and bin Laden is Youssef's uncle, Zahid Sheikh, who was the regional manager of Mercy International Relief, a charity based in Peshawar, Pakistan, during the mid-1990s. At the same time, Mercy International Relief's Nairobi branch worked closely with Al-Qaeda, issuing identity cards to bin Laden and Ali Mohammed. After a police raid on Wadi El-Hajj's house in Nairobi in 1997, 8 boxes of his personal papers were stored at the charity's office in the city. Again, noting the Dollars for Terror information about Mercy International's alleged connections to Al-Taqwa and to Gulf Office. Again, the key phrase here is networking. The various programs that I've done over the years are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist, one word, .com, spitfirelist.com. The various programs that I've done have detailed annotated descriptions in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That is also equipped with real audio and carries the 2 most recent half-hour segments for about a week, and we'll have those up probably by midweek. In the detailed annotated descriptions of the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM that have the For the Record programs available on real audio, more recent programs streaming, older programs available for download only on real audio. This concludes For the Record Program 361, Side 2, Networking, being recorded on June 2nd of 2002. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.